likes to tell his philosophy classes, the word philosophy comes from the Greek word philosophia, which means philosophy. When you think about that, I think that's at least something to think about. Now, I want in the first thing I'll show you. This is, I want to review from last time. You remember the last time I'd ended up with some slides that were showing examples of logical fallacies. And I gave one by Richard Posner. And I was a bit concerned because I was kind of rushing through it. I had gone a bit over time that I hadn't really explained what was going on in his selection very well. Remember, if you just take a couple minutes to look over what he's saying, he's talking about critics, people who criticize judicial review. Remember, judicial review in the American constitutional system is where the federal courts can say of laws passed by the states or Congress, they can look them over and say, these laws are unconstitutional, and they can overrule them. So Posner was considering the criticism of this judicial review that some people say, well, judicial review just enables these elitist judges to impose their values on the rest of us. And then Posner responded to that. He said, well, look, democracy has some problems also. Say sometimes democratic votes don't respect the values or rights of others. And I said when I was criticizing, Yankees change the subject. He's ignored this. He's changed the subject because he's supposed to be replying to a criticism, talk about a criticism of judicial review, but he's talking about problems of democracy. So I think you can see he's changed the subject, but what I don't think I made clear is why, from his point of view, is he talking about democracy at all? I mean, you could say, well, sure, it's a different subject from judicial review, but what we have to see, what is the point of what he's saying, so then I think we can see better what the fallacy is. Well, he's imagining, say, if somebody objects to judicial review, somebody doesn't like the system where the judges can find laws unconstitutional, he's thinking, well, then we would have to say that whatever laws were passed by the legislature were all right. So we have to accept those and then say, well, what if something is wrong with those laws? And the problem is that whatever the difficulties or the faults of a system where a majority decided all laws and that would be it, that need not be the alternative to judicial review. We could have a system, say, where there were state legislatures could overrule laws, and we could have all sorts of other systems other than direct democracy, which is the one he's saying is the alternative to judicial review. So he shifted the issue. He shifted the issue and started talking about problems of democracy, and he's done this because he's putting in an assumption that his opponents, namely the people who oppose judicial review, don't have to accept. They don't have to accept that democracy, majority rule democracy, is the alternative to judicial review. So Joyce calls this a false cause fallacy. He's just importing into the argument an assumption that you don't have to adopt. So that's what's wrong with the argument. I hope it's a bit clear. Now, I wanted to do one more matter of review. This is something you it came up, I noticed on the quizzes, as you know, if those of you have taken my quizzes, and I don't make them very difficult, but there was a point that a few people didn't get, and it's a bit confusing. What I want to make clear is, suppose we have an I proposition. Remember, an I proposition is a particular affirmative, like some logic lecturers are crazy. Okay, so that's a particular affirmative. Now, in the way we're doing in this system of scholastic logic, if I say some logic lecturers are crazy, that doesn't imply the falsity of all logic lecturers are crazy. It could still be the case that all logic lecturers are crazy. I just said some are, but that leaves open whether all of them are. And this is a bit confusing because sometimes in ordinary language, it doesn't work this way. I gave the example. Suppose I say some presidents of the United States were 35 years old or older when they took office. Well, they all are, but in ordinary language, if I just said some of them are 35, I wouldn't say that if they all are. It would be an unusual thing to say, but it isn't an implication in logic. It's just a convention of language that. So you have to, if you're, in order to grasp the system, the scholastic logic system that we're using, you have to disregard that. So it's some leaves open the possibility of all. And then also in scholastic logic, suppose I say all people who take my course are outstanding. It follows that some people who take my course are outstanding. So all entails some, and some leaves open the possibility of all. So that's basically what you have to remember. Okay, now we can get into the subject of the chapter that we had today. Now, it was only a few pages that we had, but the reason I just had a very short selection was I thought this is rather difficult material, so I wanted to concentrate on this and explain what's going on, even though it's just a few pages. Those of you who think you're not getting enough reading, don't worry. For the next few weeks, you'll have, I think, much more reading, so you don't have to worry about not having enough work to do. Okay, now, when we're talking about logical laws, these are the basic laws of the whole of the discipline of logic. Joyce points out that every science has certain basic assumptions that apply to the science, and logic is these basic principles are much more wide-ranging, say, than the assumptions of particular science, like basic assumptions of physics or biology. Basic principles of logic apply to all our thought. In the sense that if we have to observe these principles of logic if we want to have valid thought. Remember, valid thought is one that will give the correct reasoning. It doesn't ensure that our conclusions will be true unless we start with true premises. But unless we follow the laws of logic, then we won't be reasoning validly. So when we say the laws of logic, as I say, they're laws of thought, and Joyce distinguishes laws of thought from what he calls laws of reality, or metaphysical laws. Now, this is a bit confusing in that thought is our logic. Thought is part of reality too. So, you know, you want to know what does he mean when he distinguishes laws of thought from laws of reality. Well, I think he's not meaning to suggest that the laws of thought are not hold of reality. It's just that they just deal just with thought, and laws of reality would apply to everything, not just thought, but other matters than thought. So the metaphysical laws are more comprehensive than the laws of thought. Now he gives, it's interesting, there's an example here of a metaphysical law. The law, every event has a cause. By event, he means whatever, something that takes place in time. Now, I want to ask the class, what is the difference between saying every event has a cause and every effect has a cause? I mentioned that this is we have to draw a distinction there. Would anybody like to try that? What's the difference between saying every event has a cause and every effect has a cause? Yes, that's a Matt says effect is a subset of event. Yes. I think you could have effects that weren't events, though. Anish, I think is close to it. Yes, that's right. Joel said an effect implies a cause. If you say every effect has a cause, this is what Joyce calls an analytic proposition. It's true because of the meaning of the concept, but every event has a cause isn't an analytic statement. You would have to establish it. He thinks it's a metaphysical law, so you would have to come up with some argument that it is. It wouldn't just be enough to say, well, it's part of the concept of event that it has to have a cause. Just to see the distinction, say we have this example. Suppose I say every divorced person has been married. Well, this is true because of the concept of a divorced person implies that the person has previously been married. You can't be divorced unless you've been married. But if I say every person has been married, that's not an analytic statement. It's not a true statement, since some people haven't been married. But you see the difference. That person does not, it's not part of the concept of a person that he be married, but it is part of the concept of being divorced that the person who's divorced is married. Now, if someone's asked, we can observe an event but not an effect. Well, I don't think that's right. I mean, supposing I have a glass of water here, supposing I knock it over, well, my knocking it over caused it to fall, the glass to fall over, but if I had the glass on camera, you'd be able to see that. I'm not going to knock it over just to show you, make a point. That would be too much trouble. Jeremy asked, I think, a very interesting question. How is physics related to logic? Well, logic applies to thought about the material world, the atomic particles and all sorts of things studied by physics as well as to other subjects. So if all the sciences have to follow the laws of logic if they're to reason validly. So it isn't a branch of logic, it's just that it's governed by logic. So when we talked about logical laws, we have to ask, what do we mean by a law of logic? What does it mean to say something is a law? And I think Joyce distinguishes, I think, very usefully, three different senses of law. In the first of these, a law is simply an act, say, passed by a government or a legislature. Suppose we say it's a law that you have to pay your taxes. This is obviously not what the laws of logic are. They're not laws in that sense. It isn't there's some academy or logic that's passed laws saying these are the laws you have to follow. So it isn't a law in the sense of an act of legislation. Now the second sense of law Joyce mentions is a scientific regularity. I should say, I see some people are complaining about the size of the slides. Let me handle complaints in the way I like to do. I'm not responsible for this. I didn't make up these slides. I have them. Someone makes them. I guess we didn't make them large enough, but as long as you remember, I'm off the hook. That's all that counts. I have a question here. Are the logical laws results of observation? Well, that's a very good question. I'm going to answer that just right now. So your this green is the question is right in tune with how I'm thinking in the lecture. So the second sense is that of a scientific regularity. Say we observe certain constancies in nature. Say we drop an object, it'll fall down. So we can get the various laws of gravitation. We have regularities. Well, are laws of logic regularities in that way? Well, no, they're not, because people don't always follow them. And it doesn't, supposing we did have some people did have certain regularities in their thought, that wouldn't show that they were doing the right thing, that they were reasoning correctly. That would just show they're always doing that. So what we want is this third sense, which is kind of a normative sense of law. I mean, this is what you ought to be doing if you want to think correctly. Say you ought to avoid contradictions. It would mean it's a law in the sense if you don't avoid contradictions, then you won't be thinking correctly. It isn't that everybody always does avoid contradictions. People usually don't hold a contradiction consciously, but sometimes people do have contradictory beliefs. In fact, probably everyone has contradictory beliefs. I'll just give you an example. You might think about this. Suppose I think, I'm not always right. I'm not infallible. So that means I think at least one of my beliefs is wrong, but I believe every one of my beliefs, so I believe about one of my beliefs, at least that one of my beliefs is wrong, and also that the belief is correct. I just don't know which one or more it is, so I have a contradictory belief there. You see, so people, you don't have to pay much attention to that. That's just a philosophical puzzle that people talked about. Basically, you have to remember is the laws of logic are normative laws. They're telling you how you should think if you want to be correct. Now let's go on to the next one. Okay, now The first of these laws, I was a bit surprised the way Joyce presents these laws, that he presents what he calls a law of contradiction before the law of identity. I was used to seeing law of identity first, but when he does it this way, he's in line with the medieval tradition. The medievals thought the law of contradiction was what they call the most certain of all principles. So what the law of contradiction is, or is sometimes called law of non-contradiction, is, you remember when we're talking in the basic proposition form, you have it, you know, you have your subject and predicate. The subject is something like Socrates is mortal. So we can take the predicate, which is the attribute that we're saying the subject has, as Socrates is mortal, and we can have the notion of the contradictory of that predicate, which in this case would be not mortal. So we would have, for every predicate, we can have a contradictory of that predicate. So the law of contradiction says, you can't be true that the subject has both a certain attribute and the contradictory of that attribute at the same time. It can't be both that Socrates is mortal and Socrates is not mortal. You can't have both sides of a contradiction. Now, it's important to grasp that when we say this, that you can't have both sides of contradiction, you have to understand the attribute or the predicate in exactly the same sense in both parts of the contradiction. Suppose you say, well, Socrates was mortal in the sense that he died in 399 BC, so he died at a particular time. But in the same way, he's immortal, people have remembered him and thought about him ever since. He's a cultural icon, so he's immortal. Here, we wouldn't be using mortal and non-mortal in the same sense. We would have kind of a metaphorical sense of saying Socrates is immortal. We don't mean that Socrates has never literally died. So that wouldn't be a violation of the law of contradiction. So the basic thing you have to remember is, and also it's that the contradiction, the predicates have to apply at the same time. Suppose we would say something like Kobe Bryant is short. Well, that could have been true when he was born, but it's not true now. Say that Kobe Bryant is tall, he's tall now. So that isn't a contradiction because it's not at the same time. So it's just, if you can't apply two predicates, the same subject, that are contradictories, the predicate taken exactly at the same time. Now, how do we know that this law of contradiction is true? The scholastic said this is the most certain of all propositions. Well, basically, it's just something we can directly grasp as soon as we understand it. We see that this law of contradiction is true. It wouldn't make sense to say that, suppose I said, well, I'm giving a logic lecture, and it's also the case in exactly the same sense, but I'm not giving a logic lecture. That really wouldn't make much sense. So this is what the law of contradiction is. Now, the fact that it very obviously the case that this law is true hasn't stopped some modern logicians from coming up with systems where the law of contradiction doesn't hold, where they admit contradictions into their logical system. Now, if someone does this, if you have a contradiction, say there's some proposition, you say this is a contradiction, but I'm admitting it into the logical system, then you're going to get a problem that's called contradiction explosion. I like that name, contradiction explosion. It has a nice ring to it. Now what this means, this is not something that Joyce goes into, because when he was writing, people hadn't developed these unusual systems of logic, is that if you have a contradictory proposition, there's a fairly easy argument. I'm not going to go into it now, but it shows that you can derive any proposition you want once you admit the contradiction into your system. I'm not going to go through this, because to do this, we would have to go into hypothetical propositions. We haven't gotten to that yet. That's coming up in some of the subsequent lectures. So if you admit a contradiction into your system, then you're going to be able to deduce any proposition. So people who want to admit contradiction have to block that contradiction explosion. They have ways of doing that. So that's really, if you don't see the intuitive force of the law of contradiction, then you have to another way of seeing what's wrong with admitting contradiction is you have this problem of contradiction explosion. Now, suppose I mentioned briefly hypotheticals. Suppose we take hypotheticals with different with contradictory consequence. Suppose I say, if I give a logic lecture, I'll put everyone to sleep. And if I give a logic lecture, it's not the case that I'll put everyone to sleep. Now, what does that violate? Would anybody tell me this doesn't violate the law of non-contradiction? Let me give you an example of that. If I give a logic lecture, I'll put everyone to sleep. And if I give a logic lecture, it's not the case that I'll put everyone to sleep. Could anyone say why doesn't this violate the law of contradiction? And I just see Danny has mentioned the six impossible things for breakfast. Do you know who was Lewis Carroll making fun of when he said that? There's a man called Impossible, they used the nickname Impossibility Ward. He was someone who said he liked to have, he would believe, he liked to have all sorts of infallible decrees issued by the Vatican, so they were making fun of him. Now, Israel says, well, I'm talking about exactly the same lecture at the same time, and everything means the same. So I've got, if I give this very logic lecture, I'll put everyone to sleep. And if I give exactly this lecture, it's not the case that I'll put everyone to sleep. So why doesn't that violate the law of contradiction? Yes, Eric has this right. It's in order to violate the law of contradiction, I have to be asserting the existence of something. All I've said in these two hypotheticals is, if I give a logic lecture, I'll put everyone to sleep. And if I give a logic lecture, it's not the case that I'll put everyone to sleep. So I haven't asserted anything. It's just so long as I don't give the lecture, then there's no problem of having these contradictory predicates. I only get in trouble if I actually give a lecture, then it can't be the case that both are true. It can't be the case, once I give a lecture, it can't be the case that I put everyone to sleep, and it's not the case I put everyone to sleep. So this isn't a problem about varying sense, although that's extremely important, but basically it's just you have this applies, law of contradiction applies only to categorical statements, not to hypotheticals. Okay, now, sometimes you'll hear this argument raised. It's something like, suppose somebody denied the law of contradiction. He said, it's all right if you, at least in some cases, if you say a subject has a certain predicate and also has the contradictory of that predicate. There's some true contradictions. Would this person be vulnerable to this argument? So you say to the person, well, look, you've denied the law of contradiction. The law of contradiction is false, then you've also affirmed the law of contradiction. So what you're saying is self-refuting. You see what the argument is. It's saying to the if you say law of contradiction isn't true, but then it is true because law of contradiction is false, then the contradictory of your proposition, namely law of contradiction is true, is also true. So your attempt to deny the law of contradiction doesn't work. Now that's a bit tricky, but does anyone want to say, does that sound like a good argument? Is something, what if anything is wrong with that? I guess it's on the slide, so it won't be too hard to figure out. What would be meant if you say someone says the law of contradiction doesn't hold? He could mean that it never holds, or it could just mean he thinks that there are some cases in which there are true contradictions, whatever that means. I find difficulty understanding that, but that would be, suppose somebody says, well, I think there are true contradictions, there are at least one true contradiction. That wouldn't commit him to saying that his own statement is subject to this kind of attack, because he could say, well, in all the other cases, then law of contradiction holds. So he wouldn't be vulnerable to that that problem. It's a more limited argument than sometimes people think. Sometimes people give that as a defense of law of contradiction, but it really isn't correct. If you take these logicians that I mentioned who allow some true contradictions, aren't vulnerable to that because they don't assert the law of contradiction is universally false. Now the next one is one that's the famous one that the objectivist mentioned when they have the famous law A is A. This is the law of identity. And this law is even simpler in a way than the law of contradiction. Law of contradiction says a subject can't have contradictory predicates. You can't have both. It can't be that Socrates is mortal and Socrates is not mortal. Now, the law of identity just says whatever exists, and everything has the properties that it does. As the Bishop Joseph Butler, the great moral philosopher, theologian in the early 18th century, said, everything is what it is and not another thing. So it's something you can't really question. I mean, I don't, it's some people, now, some people think, Joyce appears to be one of the, that this is just another way of saying the law of contradiction. He says, well, if you, it's just sort of the positive way of saying what the law of contradiction says, something can't have contradictory predicates. And sort of another way of looking at that same law is to say that a subject has whatever predicates it does. I'm not sure I understand that fully what he means, but if you find that helpful, you can take what Julie said. Now, someone was asked, wants to make a distinction between something exists and not be real, or vice versa. Example of unicorns, an imaginary animal. Well, here, this is one point Joyce makes. He's just, when we talk about exist, we're not saying everything exists in the sense it's there in reality, but it's just existing in the sense that we have a concept of it. It's more of a conceptual existence he's talking about rather than an existence in reality. Now, remember in the lectures I gave, the first two lectures, I have examples of logical fallacies toward the end, but I want to give one example where we're going to look at an argument, see what's wrong with it right now, because it's very relevant to what I've just been talking about, the law of identity. Now, you have to be very careful when we talk about law of identity, and this would apply to the other logical laws, not build into this law more than it's saying. You know, say something very simple, it's just saying thing is what it is, it has whatever properties it does. And some people think that they can get very important conclusions about metaphysics, about reality, just from the law of identity. And I want to go, and here we'll be looking, we'll look at one example of someone who does this. This is from the objectivist philosopher Leonard Peikoff, who's the, I tell you a story that involves him. When I first started doing book reviews for Inquiry Magazine in 1979, I did a very negative review of a book that Peikoff wrote called Ominous Parallels. And this got me into enormous trouble with the objectivists. They really were after me for a long time, so this put Peikoff permanently on my bad list. I like criticizing other people, but I don't like when people attack me, even if I've attacked them first. I mean, it's only fair that they not attack me in return. So what Peikoff and the other objectivists say is, suppose we have the law of identity. Everything has certain whatever properties it does. Then he thinks we can deduce the law of causation from it. Remember, gave Joyce gave his example, every event has a cause. Peikoff thinks we can get this principle of causality, every event has a cause, from the law of identity, and it works in such a way that everything must have the whatever properties it does. It isn't say that, suppose I say Socrates is mortal. It has to be the case that it's not just the property it would happen to have. Well, that wasn't such a good example because that is an essential property. Let's forget that example. Suppose I say, my glass of water fell over. But Peikoff thinks it follows from the law of identity that my glass had to fall over at that particular time when it did. And he exempts human decisions from this universal determinism. So that's Eric points that out. Yeah, that this is part of Peikoff's system. He doesn't want objectivism, and it doesn't apply this to human decisions. So let's take an example, and this is one that he gives, I think, a very good example. He gives, he says, let's imagine we have a helium balloon, and somebody could just said, well, it could go either up or down at a particular time. You know, you get other examples, say, in quantum mechanics, you say, an electron could go through one slit or the other slit at a particular time. Suppose somebody said, it could do either, neither one is caused, it could just be one or the other. Peter asked, how is human action exceptional? I'm not going to get into details of their system, but they don't think that. They think people really have choice. It isn't the case. Causality doesn't require you to choose a particular way. You could choose in different ways, and that would be consistent with causality. But they think for anything other than human decisions, the law of identity requires that an object have whatever properties it does. Well, it seems like, let's take his example with the balloon going up or down, it seems like that isn't a violation of a law of contradiction, because we're not saying that the balloon goes up and not up but down at the same time. We just say, well, it could go up in another possibility, it could go down. So it doesn't seem like it's a violation law of contradiction, of identity. But Peikoff would then say, look, the problem is, suppose you say the balloon could go either up or down, then you're saying that the properties of the helium balloon just before that are such that they could cause either the balloon to go up or cause it to go down. So that isn't that ascribing contradictory properties to the balloon, because we're saying that the balloon just before it went up or down had these contradictory properties. It could, the properties could make it, the properties could make it go up or go down. Now, do you understand what the argument is saying? It's saying, look, if you say that the balloon could go either up or down, then just before that, the balloon would have had to have contradictory properties, and this violates law of contradiction, law of identity. It just has whatever the properties it has. It can't have a property both making it go up and making it go down at the same time. Now, this is a tough one, but can anyone see what fallacy is being committed here? Anybody? You're not going to, yes, Andrea says, begging the question, yes, and Joel, yes, it's good. We have some excellent students here, good, good. You see, the basic problem is, who said anything about causation at all? Supposing the balloon just goes up or goes down without anything causing it, then we haven't ascribed any contradictory properties to it. We just said, well, it went up, and the fact that it might have gone down isn't a contradictory property. Now, if then Peikoff says, oh, but look, then if you're saying that something can come into existence, could just an event come into existence without a cause, you know, this violates the law of causality. You can't do that, because the law of causality is basic. But here's where the begging question comes in. Remember, he's trying to argue that the law of causality follows from the law of identity, but he's assuming the law of causality in his own argument. So he's arguing for the law of causality follows from the law of identity by assuming that the law of causality holds. So he's assuming what he's trying to prove. He's begging the question. So you see, he's begged the question. Now, I'm not saying that I think things can just come, or properties can come into existence without a cause. Remember, we're not concerned here with whether the argument comes to a true conclusion, but simply whether it's a good argument. And it isn't, because it's assuming, it's taking for granted what it's supposed to be proving. It's supposed to be proving the law of causality follows from the law, the logical law, but it assumes this principle of causality in order to make the argument that causality holds. And there's other problems with the argument, but I'm not going to go into that now. I've confused you enough already. Let me see. So the next one, we covered the law of contradiction, law of identity. Now we now have the third of the logical laws, law of excluded middle. Now, the way to understand this is, let's go back to our example, law of contradiction, where we say Socrates is mortal, and let's take the contradiction that Socrates is not mortal. The law of contradiction, we say both can't be true at the same time. It can't be that Socrates is mortal and Socrates is not mortal at the same time. Now, the law of excluded middle says that one of the two contradictory judgments has to apply. It must be the case that either Socrates is mortal or Socrates is not mortal. There's no third, as Aristotle says. It's one or the other. So again, law of contradiction says not both of the contradictories. You can't have both. The law of excluded middle is you have to have one. Now, as you would expect, you know, I mentioned there are people who don't think the law of contradiction holds universally. They're logicians that deny that, and they have their own systems. There are people who've developed logics where law of excluded middle doesn't apply. Like they would have some people like Michael Dummett, who was one of the greatest 20th century philosophers, a philosopher at Oxford, had the view, suppose I say it rained in the area that's now Los Angeles 80,000 BC on the Ides of March. Now, supposing no one has a way of determining whether that's true or not, it turns out there are no tests we could perform to find out whether that's true or not. So Dummett thinks it might be that the law of excluded middle doesn't hold in such a case, that if there's no way in principle to find out what happened, whether it's true that it rained or it's true it's not the case it rained, he thinks that this law might not apply. And this is something people sometimes call this the law of bivalence. So there are some logicians, not Joyce, or not the ones not in the system we're studying, that do deny law of excluded middle. And then one thing you have to realize also on law of excluded middle is that the proposition has to make sense in order to apply law of excluded in the middle. Suppose I say something like circles are either evil or not evil. Well, it wouldn't make sense to say that a circle has some kind of moral property of being evil or morally good. I mean, we could talk about good circles in the sense of circles that are well drawn, but we wouldn't have the case of it wouldn't apply in the the proposition wouldn't make sense. Now, someone has asked me, Eric says, there's no way to validate the that would be the view that it's sort of an oversimplification of Dummett's view, but he does hold that view. It's not the view we're taking here. I just wanted to mention it. That is one view that people, that he hold, that some people held. Danny has a very interesting quotation from Mises. I think people should study in evil circles. What Greg says is a repugnant concept, but Joyce calls it wouldn't make sense. Now, someone asked me to discuss the Schrodinger's cat example. I don't know enough quantum mechanics to go into that, but when it says, he says the cat is alive and the cat is not alive at the same time. Well, you see, but the difficulty I have there is the way it's taken in that example. You can't, it's wrong to say the cat is alive and not alive at the same time. It's just certain quantum superpositions are present at the same time. And you can't, I don't think you could say that those superpositions are either alive or not alive. This would be one of these ill-formed propositions. I don't want to get a bit sidetracked, but Matt asked, how would logicians respond if someone said, well, just because we can't know whether it rained on a certain day doesn't mean we either did or did not rain on that day. Well, they would just deny that. They would say in their system, they hold that to be indeterminate. Maybe I should have gone on so much about that. It's just that I just want you to know that there are people who don't accept that view. I should have mentioned before, I'll mention it now. When we're talking about law of excluded middle, you know, we say something has to have one of the two contradictory predicates. We have to distinguish between contraries and contradictions. Remember, this was something that gave some people a bit of trouble on one of the quizzes. Contrary terms, sometimes say we have a genus, or it can be divided, say, into different species or classes. So contrary terms are ones at the furthest extremes of the classes. Like, suppose we have moral goodness, say, well, we have saintly people, say, we have Mother Teresa at one end, and say we have Hitler or Stalin at the other end, so the really evil people. So it would be contrary, if you said someone who's absolutely evil and someone who's saintly, so it would be contrary. So it's not the case that the law of excluded middle applies to contrary. Something doesn't have to be either saintly or absolutely evil, but it's contradictories that it applies to. Now, I wanted to, however, we can talk about contradictory and contrary terms. We also, this wasn't in the reading, but I just want to go over a bit of terminology that we can be very useful for us in the remaining lectures. When we talk about contradictory propositions, remember we have an A proposition, a universal affirmative. We have all men are mortal. Now, the contradictory of a universal affirmative is a particular negative, an O proposition. So we have all men are mortal. The contradictory would be some men are not mortal. And say we have a universal negative, an E proposition, the contradictory of that is a particular affirmative. Say we have no men are mortal. That's a universal negative. So the contradictory is a particular affirmative. Some man is mortal. And also, so that's what the logical contradictories are. Now, we can also talk about contrary propositions, contrary judgments. Here, that would be contrary judgments, or an A and an E. Like, all men are mortal and no men are mortal. That's a contradict. Those are contrary propositions. So it's important, don't confuse contradictory and contrary propositions. That's contrary to reason if you do that. Now, one other very useful bit of terminology, and this will need this for the lecture next time, assuming I live so long, when we talk about actual how we do reasoning and syllogism, we have a distributed and undistributed terms. Remember, when we have a proposition, say we have all men are mortal, we can take the subject and predicate of classes. We say, classes like all men, we talk about the class of men, and then mortals, we talk about the class of mortals. So a distributed term is one that we're talking about the entire class. Say we talk about all men, we're talking about the entire class of men. But an undistributed term is one where we don't know how much of the class we're talking about. So we say all men are mortal. Well, we don't know, does this immortals limited to men? Well, we know in fact that's they're not, but just from the proposition, we don't know how much of the mortals are to be included in this particular proposition. So we don't really know. It's left open how many mortals we talk about. So that would be an undistributed term. So that's one of the terms we have to realize, distributed and undistributed terms. So that will help us in the next lectures. I, as usual, I'm running a bit late, but I'll just go over a few minutes. I have a couple examples of what I think are, I want to show you some errors in reasoning again. Remember, the main thing we're trying to do in the course is show you how to reason correct, how to be able to spot fallacies. So this first one, you just take a couple minutes to read that, assuming you can make out the print all right. This is an argument from a book by Peter Ubel on something on how bad the market is. What he says is he's blaming the free market for the obesity epidemic. He thinks we're all getting fat because of the free market. And his reasoning is, well, people have all these, they can prepare food much more easily than they could in the past because we have all these ways of preparing food very fast, and we have all these innovations in technology. So the free market is to blame for this. So then he said, well, supposing somebody says, okay, I don't accept that the free market is to blame for the obesity epidemic. Then he says, well, then the people, he's trying to say, give some consequence that people like the free market wouldn't accept. He's saying, well, then you have to say the free market isn't responsible for prosperity or all these other things, because suppose somebody said, look, we had the free, somebody would be arguing, said, well, look, we had the free market long before the obesity epidemic, so we can't say the free market is responsible for obesity. But then he says, well, couldn't you then say we had the free market before prosperity, so the free market isn't responsible for prosperity either. So you see what is in argument here. Now, what's wrong with this argument is he's shifted the issue. This seems to be the one fallacy I've spent most time talking about, the ignoratio elenchi. Not say it doesn't commit other fallacies as well, but what he's done here is his argument is that the obesity epidemic is caused first by having these new ways of preparing food that are easier. And then he goes on to argue that the free market is responsible for these new ways of preparing food. So the free market is responsible for the obesity epidemic. So again, there are various problems about his views of causation, but the basic thing to see here is that his argument relies on the contention that these technological developments caused the obesity epidemic. So if somebody, what he has to do is meet the counter argument that we had the technological developments before the obesity epidemic, so it didn't cause that epidemic, and we had ways of preparing food in this efficient way before people started getting fat. So we can't say it caused that. So that's what he needs to be talking about, but instead he's talking about whether the free market can be held responsible for the technological development. So he's begging the question, because he's taking for granted that his account of the immediate cause, the obesity epidemic, namely the technological developments, holds. If that doesn't hold, it doesn't matter whether the free market caused the technological development. So he shifted the issue improperly to whether the free market caused the technology, when what the issue, the subject of the argument is, did the technological developments cause the obesity epidemic? Now, in the last one I'll give, now this is one thing you have, I think in fallacies, you have to be very careful. Suppose an author gives you a conclusion that you like or you agree with, you have to be very careful in seeing whether he's argued for it correctly. Now, here I've taken an argument from a very good political philosopher and economist, Anthony de Yassé's, a libertarian political theorist. And so what he argues is that he's arguing in favor of a view of property, that you can acquire unowned property by claiming it. And he gives this argument. He said, well, let's suppose somebody claims unowned property. There's some land out there, nobody owns it, and I claim it. I say, this is my land. So then he says, well, nobody could object that this violates his rights, because by assumption the property is unowned, so therefore the claim has to be accepted. No one has any grounds to object, because by hypothesis the property is unowned. Now, can anyone see what's the matter with that argument? Well, so Mike claims the universe. Well, that's very good. I remember I once gave Bob Nozick the example. Somebody said, I claim all the unowned property in the world. Eric, I think, is closer. What the problem is that he's assuming that the only claims to property are ownership claims. Like, say, if you own property, that means you can then exclude people. But I mean, supposing someone said, well, I don't own this property that you're claiming, but I was free to use it before you claimed it. And now, once you claim it and you own it, now you're saying you have the right to stop me from using it. So you are interfering with my rights. Now, I'm not saying such a claim would be correct. It's just a logical problem with the argument. He's assuming wrongly that there are no rights to property other than ownership rights. So he's begging the question that he's assuming one thing he would have to be proving. Yes, that's right. Exclusive use is an indicator of ownership. So the question would be, in saying by claiming the property, he claims the right to use it exclusively, is it logically ruled out that anyone could object to that once we said the property started off unowned, and I'm claiming no, he hasn't shown that? Well, I guess that brings our slides to the close. Now, if you think you had a problem seeing the slides, you should see how small they are from my end of things. I couldn't see them at all. So, now remember, just one thing on this example, we're not concerned here with what's the correct theory of ownership. It might be that he has the correct theory of ownership. I'm only concerned with the structure of this particular argument. Okay, so I think we'll stop here, and we can have questions, objections. Now, Alan asked an interesting point. He said, suppose he said, would he be correct? Suppose he said, no one has ever used the property. Would he then be correct to say no one would have any claims against him? Well, not necessarily, because somebody could say, even though I never used this particular property, you still have no right to stop me from using it just by claiming it. Again, I think people can acquire property by homesteading, but I'm just concerned here with the logic of the argument. Okay, so does anybody have anything for me? Someone asked, would it be possible to post the slides a few days in advance of the lecture? Well, I did. Sometimes people want it that way, but there are two problems there. There are three problems, actually. There, one is that I wanted, on these examples of bad arguments, I want you to be able to look at the argument, try to come up with the problems right away. And the second problem is that it takes me a while to get these ready. And the third problem is the person who's nice enough to prepare these for me also takes some time to do it. Let me see. So, do we have some? Someone, Andrea said, did I know Nozick? Yes, I knew Nozick for 20 years. I knew him very well. I used to call him up all the time and try to get an argument by him. It was very difficult to do. He was extraordinarily fast in arguments. Yes, he used to send me manuscripts for his books, and so I got to read a lot of them. He was a very good thinker. Jeremy asked, how could the last argument be structured without violating these rules? Well, I think what you'd have to do is make some substantive claims. Like you could say something like, you think it's the case that, which I think I personally would think is right, you could take kind of a view that someone who homesteads property in a certain way acquires it. But you see, the point there would be, you would be making a particular claim about what is the correct view of property. You wouldn't be saying that you can establish just by thinking the logic of the concept of acquiring property, that there couldn't be any objections to this. What D'Asso is saying is, look, if you claim the property and it's unowned, then it logically doesn't make sense for anybody to object to it, because if it's unowned, then no one has any rights to it. But that isn't a logic to say if something is unowned, nobody has any rights to it. You might hold that's true, but it's not something logically required. Let me see something here. The golden mean, you see, the golden mean isn't, I think this is right, isn't saying that it isn't a mean between two contradictory properties. Now, Brian says, could you review the distinction between every effect and every event has a cause? Well, suppose an event would be, say, something like an occurrence that takes place in time. So those, suppose you say every event has a cause. Well, that's something you might have arguments for that, or you might have various reasons for thinking that's true, but it isn't something that you can see to be true just by asking what does event mean. So you say, well, what's in the concept of something that takes place at a certain time? It doesn't seem like in that concept is the concept of having a cause. Suppose you just said, here's an event, it just popped into existence, it didn't have a cause. I don't think you'd be contradicting the meaning of event just by saying that. But if you said every effect has a cause, this is true just from the meaning of effect, because an effect is something that is the result of a cause. So you couldn't have an effect without a cause. Now, Eric has, can't be proven. How do you assume, how do you deal with someone who's begging, accusing you of begging the question? Well, there are actually people who say that about laws of life, but I think what you would want to say there is you're not begging the question, you're not saying a law of identity is true because you've deduced it from the law of identity. You're just saying, look, have a look at this, you'll see it's true. Now, Danny says there's some other questions I can go to. Let me click on this link first, and then I'll get back to these others. I went off the site. Wait a sec. Ooh. Hello. I've gone. It knocked me off. Help! I've been. Hello, I was knocked off. Okay. Hello, can people hear me? I'm back. Wait a sec. Hello, can people hear me? I'm back. I did something wrong here. Good. I was in, I knocked myself off the side. I'm sorry. I'll go on a few minutes. Now, how do I get, am I recording? Is this being recorded? Wait, I better press record. Okay. That was almost induced a heart attack. Now, there's a question here on Peikoff's thought balloon. Is he assuming uniform natural laws are uniform across time? Well, I guess he's assuming later when you want it. I don't think we really need the slides now. Well, it won't hinder you if you read the rest of the book. You might find bits of it confusing. I'm just dealing with certain parts of it. It's a very complicated book. But Joe asked, do I have any stories about being on the defensive versus the objectivist cult? Well, I haven't had all that much contact with the objectivists, except when they started criticizing my Peacock Review. Now, one philosopher you may know, Tibor McCann, who's sympathetic to objectivism, he's not sort of one of the people directly involved with him, but he is sympathetic. I've sometimes had a bit of trouble with him. He thinks I'm too negative in his view in his books, but I haven't had any really bad encounters with them. But I wish I had some better stories to tell you, but I don't. Now, who's my favorite philosopher thinker? Well, I mean, there are a lot of good ones, good philosophers. You know, I mean, political philosopher. Of course, I always like Murray Rothbard. In philosophers in general, you know, I mean, if you want to just confine it, you know, I mean, there just mean 20th century philosophers or all sorts of, you know, I kind of have a list of standard grades. I rate Bob Nozick very highly as a philosopher. Thomas Nagel is very good. Now, Michael asks, now, Hakim says he has to rely 90% on the book. Is he in trouble? Well, I think you'll find, you won't have much trouble with my quizzes, I don't think. Now, Michael said, is there a difference between Socrates is not mortal and is not a case that Socrates is mortal? No, those would be really the same. It's just two different ways of saying, denying that Socrates is mortal. Now, you do have, remember, Joyce has that section where he mentions some people have what they call an infinite judgment. Kant has that, where you're taking not mortal to be a positive property, but that's kind of confusing. That was funny that you could still see me, because all I saw was a site that said log into the meeting. Now Michael says, but only when there's no third possibility. That those two mean the same. Yeah, that's right. I mean, it would be when you have contradictory predicates, that's right. Eric says, Aristotle says that communication isn't possible without it. And he says, I thought it was a powerful argument. They say it still doesn't prove it. Well, I think there you could say it doesn't prove it in, there are two ways to prove it. I mean, somebody could say, okay, we probably wouldn't want to get along without communication, but that doesn't show something is true. Maybe communication rests on some sort of false assumption. I'm not saying I don't think it does, but I mean, somebody could give that. I mean, just say something is necessary for communication. It doesn't follow immediately. Something is necessary for communication. Therefore, this is true. I think the question that reason. And the other way you could question is just to say, well, what's involved in denying the law of contradiction? You wouldn't have to say that all contradictions are all right. You would just be saying some are, and that might not block communication. The question is, if you change an I proposition, like some people are mortal, to only some people are mortal, is it then an A proposition? No, you then have would be a compound proposition. You have some people are mortal and some people are not mortal. So you would have, it's a compound of two I propositions. Now, Lauren says, I'm not sure how to apply the concept in the book to the examples you give in the lectures. How the concept, could you be a bit more specific what you mean? I'm sorry if I'm doing a bad job if I'm not applying the concept in the book to the examples, but if you gave me a specific instance, I could try to answer it. Now, Ned asks, what's wrong? It's a quotation from Keynes. The quotation from Keynes is that he thinks that the marketplace should be free of government interference, but he thinks that government can play a constructive role in protecting individuals from the worst harms of capitalism cycles, especially unemployment. Then it says, when the Great Depression struck a few years later, this work seemed prescient. Assuming that because there was this depression, Great Depression, it was caused by laissez-faire economics. So I mean, it's begging the question, saying, well, look, Keynes is right because he said the free market wouldn't work by itself, and it didn't. But just from the fact that there's a depression doesn't show that the free market didn't work. And then Michael says, wouldn't the possibility of communicating deprive that response of meaning? Well, not if you didn't communicate the meaning to anybody else. I mean, you would presumably be able to think it yourself. Regarding Keynesian epistemology, that's a very good question. Anish says, would Mises' synthetic a priori proposition classified as analytic? Yes, he would, because he'd say they're not part of the definition, but they're necessary implications of the concept. Now, random question, what's my opinion? Well, I think Jean Moore was one of the great philosophers. He had very exact standards of arguing, and he's a very good person to read. I think I would think very highly of him. I think Rothbard liked scholastic logic very much, and this is the kind he went in for. And Mises doesn't say very much about it, but it's clear he doesn't have a very high opinion of scholastic philosophy. I don't know whether he would apply this to logic so much, but he doesn't like scholastic metaphysics. And he mentioned, I think he cites in Human Action a book by the French thinker Louis Rougier. I'll just put him, and you can look in Human Action for the name. Matthew says, what is reification? Is that similar to begging the question? Well, if you reify something, it would be something like you're saying, like something, you're ascribing existence, or independent existence, of something that really doesn't have it. Like, say, if you take a view that Joyce has, suppose I said, I say Socrates is mortal. Suppose I say mortality is not just an attribute that Socrates and other people have, but it somehow exists independently. There's sort of mortality out there, it's universal, and all the particular mortals participate in that universal independently of, it isn't something that just exists in them, they're being mortal, but it's sort of this independent entity called mortality. So that would be an example of reification if you take the same view of universals that Joyce does. If you didn't, you wouldn't be saying you're reifying, you're just recognizing reality. So reification is just describing existence to something that doesn't have independent existence. So it isn't the same as begging the question. Begging the question is just assuming what you're trying to prove or arguing for something on the basis of that very thing. Now, Israel said, since we can refute the claim that the law of non-conditioning is false by saying the claim requires non-conditioning, can we refute the claim that there are not objective truths by saying the statement itself is an objective truth? Well, it would be a contradiction if someone says there are no objective truths and claims that that one itself was an objective truth. I mean, you could, I think that would be an example of a self-refuting statement. Now, Michael, why did Scholastic let it pass out of fashion? Well, essentially what happened was in the late 19th century, remember I mentioned this a bit in, I think, my first lecture, there were some logicians, especially the great German logician Frege, I'll put him down. Who said scholastic logic can't handle really the logic of relations. It's just part of a much larger system. And he had his own system, Bertrand Russell and others developed this further. So they really, this sort of new mathematical logic really replaced the old style logic. Yes, repeat my definition of begging the question. Well, you're arguing for something by assuming that very thing. You're arguing that something is true just using that very contention as a premise. So I say, what would be a good case? Suppose I say people have free will because otherwise we wouldn't be free to make choices. So I'm just saying, well, people have free will because people have free will. That wouldn't be a good argument. Someone asked, Hans Hopper says that the action axiom is synthetic a priori, but it's an analytical one according to scholastic logic. What's the disconnect here? Well, it's just they're not contradicting each other because they have different accounts of what is an analytic proposition. Joyce in scholastic logic has a much wider notion of analytic propositions than the one that Hopper's using. According to the one that Hopper's using, an analytic proposition is just one that's part of the definition or follows from the definition, right? It's a tautology, but Joyce says not only are those analytic propositions, but also necessary implications of the concept count as analytic also. So someone asked, I'm not familiar with Nance and Wilson. I don't know that book. I have to have a look at it. Okay, is there anything else? Sorry for the mix-up during the... Andrea says, will you be discussing argumentation ethics in this course, and or will you ever publish your opinions on the subject? Probably no, and no, that would be get me into big trouble. What are essential distinctions between logic, epistemology, and philosophy of mind? Well, logic is what we're talking about in this course is the rules for correct thinking. Now, epistemology is how do we know things? What is what things can we know? How do we know there's an external world? What is the what counts as say in perception? Do we see things directly? Do we only see representations of things? There, the top, there's some overlapping, because we could say what counts as evidence could be the topic in logic or epistemology. Epistemology is how do we know things. Philosophy of mind would be what is the nature of mind? Is mind different from purely material? Is it identical with the brain, or is it independent? Is it something completely different? What is the, how does consciousness arise? What's the nature of consciousness? That would be a sort of thing. And now Anish says, what about Nietzsche's criticism? Well, you see that what he says, when you say something's made possible by a faculty, you haven't really explained what makes it possible. You just said it has there's something that's making it possible, but you're really not saying anything. Now, that's a standard criticism of scholastics. You know, and then Molière mentions that criticism in one of his plays, and he says people explain why opium puts you to sleep, because they say it has a dormative virtue. That just means it puts you to sleep. So I think the criticism is right if you just say there's a faculty of producing something. You don't have any account of the faculty. You haven't really said very much, but it isn't nothing. I mean, you would know, if you say something's come about by a faculty, you know it doesn't come randomly. So you're saying something that's not a completely empty proposition. Well, I think we're about out of time now, so then I'm sorry for the mix-up, and I guess we'll, unless, does anybody have any last questions? Otherwise, I guess we can end things. Andre says, the logic and epistemology would overlap more. Well, Kant has sort of extends logic, what he calls a transcendental logic, but his system, very complicated, and I don't think that I couldn't explain that in a few minutes, but well, thanks very much. Thanks to everybody for coming to my lecture. I appreciate it, and hope to see you next week. Thanks a lot. So do I press the stop recording? Thank you. Do I press the stop recording button now? Okay. Save. Okay.